Eric.
Hey, Charles.
How you doing, man?
Good.
Excellent. So what's going on?
Yeah, where are we, Charles?
I don't know. Are we allowed to say?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Okay, so we're in a conference room in one of the buildings. I think it's building 115.
Yeah.
Excellent. We walked over over our nice new bridge that we have on campus.
Yes. And so who are we talking with, Charles?
Well,
this is one of your old friends.
Yeah. Hey, it's Rick Malloy.
Hi.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing great.
It's been a long time.
It has. It's been a couple years, I think.
Absolutely. And you used to be on the concert team.
I was on the concert team. I worked on the concert team. I worked on C++ AMP for a little bit.
Nice.
It's now publicly disclosed, which is wonderful.
Yes.
And then about a year ago, I came over to the Startup Business Group.
Okay. Great, man.
So
great
to see you. What does this Startup Business Group do?
Well, we do startups. For example, Microsoft Tag. The group I'm in also works on Avatar Connect, which just shipped on the 360 about a week ago.
Very cool.
Which is really exciting. So it's, you know, sort of new forays, potentially new markets, new applications, get them out to the customers.
Cool.
As a result of that, it means that I can't actually tell you very much about what I'm doing specifically, but I can tell you, of course, about what I do.
Good. Well, so, but let's talk a little bit about the past, because you said you worked on concert and the kind of concurrency stuff. It seems to be that, like, actors are now kind of the big hype. So everybody's, like, doing actors. There's Erlang and, you know, there's Martin Odersky's startup where they're doing actors. Can you explain actors to, you know, the Channel Niners?
Sure. So I think of actor really as, here's a class or an object, and it's got some public ports of particular types that you communicate with it. And you give it messages through these ports. It does whatever it does, and it might produce some additional messages. I know that, like, in Erlang, when you're talking about the supervisors, you might be able to, say, monitor other actors or agents. For folks that don't know, the agents library is actually an actor-oriented model.
Yeah, so what is the difference between agents and actors?
So the,
or is this just a different name for the same thing?
It is. It's the this is sort of the classic problem. It's like, well, if an actor is the pattern, an agent, and particularly the agent's library, the agent class is a particular implementation of that pattern. Have you looked at this at all? Do you know?
Well, wait, one second. I'm going to change my chair. This one is crooked.
Okay, no problem. Keep going, man.
So the agent class in the agent's library, it gives you some lightweight state management. It gives you sort of a named class that you can, say, inherit from, where you can put your public ports for communication. And it gives you an asynchronous start routine. So it's sort of like the, you know, the initial sort of ingredients to build actors or to build, you know, an actual specific actor for your model. And, of course, the message blocks, which is, say, 80% of, you know, the code in the agents library, are those ports and those communication, you know, blocks.
And so, like, actors send messages to each other. That's what I said. Are these messages, like, synchronous or asynchronous? How does that work?
Well, in the agents library, they're actually both.
Okay.
You just choose whether you want synchronous message passing or asynchronous message passing. We're actually using them all over the place. They're the sort of the foundation of the code base I'm currently working on. It's, of course, built on Concert, but it's really built on the agents library to do all the structural, you know, structural networks of communication. It's wonderful.
And so one of the things that you see in a lot of the actor libraries is, how do you deal with cyclic things and reentrancy? Can you speak a little bit about that?
Sure. So, cyclic networks are, in fact, we're built on a cyclic network. We've basically taken, you know, if you think of a traditional Windows application, and we split it up into a data flow network that is, in fact, cyclic. And we've done it through, you know, some extensions to Concert. We built some custom schedulers. It's not something that I think people know very much about through the documentation. Is that, in fact, you can do this. Hmm. You can build custom schedulers either through, you know, the heavyweight interfaces for doing it, where, you know, companies like Intel, when we were at PDC talking about the Intel partnership there, they actually, you know, integrated that layer, you know, and support the runtime. Or you can do something more lightweight, which is, you know, here's a scheduler, much more like the TPL schedulers. And you can, in fact, then build a scheduler that understands what thread you're on. So when you send messages to those message blocks or those actors that include those message blocks, the work there will, in fact, run on the threads if it's, say, a Windows GUI thread. It takes some work to do, but it's very possible, and it's a very nice thing.
And so this is all native code?
Yeah, it's all native. I think one of the fun things, what we released the asynchronous data flow CTP.
Yep.
How long ago was that?
I think that was like 2 years ago, or 1.5 years ago.
So one of the fun things that, you know, that I get to play with is actually sending messages back and forth between these two libraries, which are very similar in spirit. And in terms of concepts. So if you understand the concepts of one, you understand the concepts of the other, because they're so closely related, I think, from a just from a domain and even from an evolution. Stephen and I talked all the time about these as he was working on the early versions of it. And he, of course, gave a lot. People don't know this. He gave a lot of feedback into the agents library and into the the native programming models. But you know, you don't see that as much.
No,
but it was absolutely there.
Awesome. Man.
And so how do you? And again, I mean, I assume that our viewers don't kind of really know, you know, this library. So like, and so I'm trying to drill in a little bit. So how do you do asynchronous calls?
So there's.
And we can use the whiteboard. That's
okay,
let's show some codes.
All right, man.
This is what it's all about, huh? So we do everything first with message blocks. And a simple one, there's a couple of simple ones. There's an overwrite buffer. These are class templates, so there's always a type. And I'll just put, you know, int or something in there. The overwrite buffer, you can send messages to it. You can always send messages to it synchronously or asynchronously using a send or an asend function template. Overwrite buffer always stores the last buffer, and when you send a message to it, it overwrites it. And you either call receive on it, or you know, can just get the value out of it. And you always get whatever it thinks is the current value of it. An unbounded buffer. Is really just what it says. It's your typical queue. And you send messages up to it. It queues them in orders, and then it produces them, and they're moved out of the queue when you get it and consumed rather than, you know, just copied. And the other one that is really critical is the transformer. And it takes, you know, say an int and produces a double. And you construct this guy with a functor.
And so, like the transformer, when you send message to it, how do you get stuff out? Is that push based, or do you pull the values out?
Both are supported, right? So I can always send, you know, messages to my. Let's just start putting together a class here. Can you see this eye?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hungarian hasn't died yet.
The private.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. You can do whatever you want. No one can actually see the code.
That's right.
Except for the dev.
You can do whatever you want.
Cool.
I actually don't enjoy putting the types in front of the things. That's one of this is one of my pet peeves, is putting the type of the thing in the variable name, because if you change the type, now you got to go change all the code.
Yep.
And I would love to just, particularly like on a function, just change the type once, right? Mm-hmm. And if your variables are correctly named, the type change doesn't matter. But, like I said, that's a little soapbox. So if I have a class that could be an actor, I've got, say, three ports here. If they're exposed, these are, you know, private. And I'll do it upside down. But publicly, right, I might have And under the covers, we have these interfaces. Targets and sources.
Okay.
Targets, you know, you send messages to, and sources produce messages. So the iTarget, the iSource class, have a function, you know, get buffer in, which would just return, let's use this guy here, m int 2, and this would be the buffer out. Return the address of this guy, our transformer, because I'm going to give him code to run.
Okay.
So this is my public interface. I really don't care anything at all other than I've got some target that takes ints and some source that produces doubles. Inside the class, if I make this derive from the agent class. In the agents library, then what I can do is I can implement a virtual method run. And inside there, I will probably connect up my network, which would say this guy, my queue. And the language in the agents library is link target. So take a source and link a target to it. In the sample path, for folks that don't know, there's a pretty good sample path for Constant. We have a set of helper guides. One of them is connect, and this is one of my favorite ones because I just say connect my queue to my output, you know, my function, and then the code matches what I tell people I do, right? Because usually, you know, there's like, oh, and then you connect them up. We'll just call it connect.
Great.
And so when I construct this guy, I just give him a function, right? Just a functor, and then you can do whatever you want. When I take this agent now, and I call start, what it does is it takes this run method and it schedules a task to do whatever's in here. At the end of that task, it's in the started state. And so if you want to have like these supervisor kind of agents, right, that will sort of actively, you know, say pull things or actively query things, you know, or even a thread that's, you know, doing networking or something where you kind of want the thing alive and you're kind of doing stuff, you could use it that way. You could also use it just simply as an asynchronous initialization where you just connect your network and then you exit. And now all you have is this object with, say, a network. I mean, this one's really simple, right? It's like this. But hopefully you have, you know, a much more interesting network. Right? And you pick one of these guys to be your output. And you can connect this more complex network asynchronously under the covers. But you're actually ready to go here as soon as the thing's constructed.
So can we, on that side of the board, drill down in these two interfaces?
Sure.
Okay. I'm very curious to see how they look like.
So just to see what they do?
Yep.
So the transformer, event and double, you construct it with a lambda. Because this is a member variable, you have to do some tricky things if you actually want to access this. If you don't, it's not a big deal.
That's fine. We are on the whiteboard. We don't have to write.
We don't have to worry about that stuff.
Don't worry about it.
Right. So if I take my function buffer, Right. I mean, you could always do something simple like, you know, int to double, right? That returns a double and takes an int. If this is just a C function, you know, return, cast it as a double or something, right? You can always do something dumb like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I construct this guy, you can just give him int double. There's more fun things you can do, actually. In addition to just giving a function, you can specify a filter. So you'd say, well, only accept messages of this type,
mm-hmm.
right? So if I have multiple message targets connected to a source, each with different filters, you can actually start filtering them and routing them. And your code doesn't need to have the filtering in it, which I always love, because I would rather do, you know, the verification before I get it, and sort of the, you know, the logic, because conditionals are somewhat evil, as far as I'm concerned. So I could have a filter function here, and you can also specify a scheduler, you know, if you have an instance of a scheduler. So what this does is, so run this code when you get a message. Filter, you know, for X types of message, filter function just takes the input and returns, you know, true or false, right? So you can filter out, you know, I could have, my filter could be, you know, is odd, right? Takes an int and, you know, just returns, you know, int. Something done, right? And then you could, so when this is constructed there, you send the buffer in, because we've connected them, you send it to the queue here.
Mm-hmm.
The queue will queue them. One of the things that's great about this transform that's built in is that things are ordered. We only actually execute one task at a time. So I might send, you know, 10 gazillion ints to this queue. And I'm going to update them in the order that I received, which is, you know, somewhat arbitrary since I sent them in parallel, in theory. But I will actually process them in the order that I got them, which is great for those cases where you do need to preserve ordering. If you want to, say, have, you know, more than one, you know.
But, and if you would have used the override buffer, then it's just,
well,
whatever.
No. So the interesting thing about the override buffer is because it is still buffered, if you just arbitrarily say, call receive. So that those are the APIs to get things out. You can call receive on a message block or try receive, you know, which tries to get a message and bails out. And of course, there's timeouts. If you call receive on the override buffer, you'll just get the last one.
Yeah.
But if an override buffer is hooked up to this guy, it'll send all of its messages as they come into the target. So you still don't lose messages. But if you need to just go say like last state, then you can just get that.
So I don't see that. So it's called override buffer, so when I send it, like, you know, 100 messages concurrently,
mm-hmm.
doesn't only one survive?
They get queued, they get put into it, right?
Okay.
Now, only one will survive publicly to the person who consumes it. So if I've just got it sitting there and I want to, say, go query the state of this buffer, I'll get whatever happens to be current, right? But if I actually have code hooked up to it in a network flow, as you send it, they'll actually propagate it through the network in order. Which is sort of this, you know, balance. You can always build custom message blocks, and if you want the, you know, you want that functionality, just, you know, just send whatever I got and don't buffer them. You can just build that. One of the, I think one of the interesting message blocks I built recently is sort of like a broadcaster. But basically, you send it a message, and anybody that happens to be connected to it at the time, it gives it to. But if there's nobody connected to it, it's just gone.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's useful, you know, if you're doing, you know, really transient things, right? You don't want actually to, you know, to keep this, you know, last state, which might not be around. That would be bad in some cases. And it wasn't that bad. There's articles on extending them. I think it took a few hours, so not too bad.
And what about these target and source interfaces? How what kind of methods do they have?
The Well, the target and source interfaces, they have like the link target method, so you can actually connect them together. Then they have a series of interfaces for, in fact, accepting the message or putting a reservation on a message, right? We have a join construct, which takes multiple inputs of, say, different types, and you can either have a greedy join or a non-greedy join, right? And a non-greedy join, we just want to reserve the message, but we don't want to actually, you know, consume it until we actually have them all, and they all say, yes, you can have it. It gives us that that two-phase commit sort of protocol so we can be reliable there. It's, of course, you know, more overhead than simply consuming the message. But if you have, say, overlapping weights and overlapping networks where you really want to say, you know, I really want to give you this marker and I don't want this marker duplicated, but I want to make sure, and this is like the dining philosopher's thing, but I want to make sure, in fact, that we don't deadlock and each end up with one marker or one chopstick, I can do that. So set it up as a non-greedy join, and we can get those kind of semantics, which are important. So it's...
That's very cool.
Yeah. I think most of these are available in the Dataflow CTP as well.
I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And the Dataflow, just to be clear, the Dataflow stuff is something that Tobe.
Yeah.
Stephen Tobe. That's how his name is pronounced.
That's right.
I've learned that over the years, Stephen, the man. That's managed code, which is great, and it's built on top of TPL.
Mm-hmm.
And you had already mentioned that. I just wanted to make it clear to people that that's what you were talking about when you were talking about the Stephen and you relationship, was you were native and he's managed.
That's right.
And you guys have had a great partnership and done great work for both communities.
Yeah.
So and this is all looks like basically native code, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you find yourself using lambdas a lot? I mean, why use functors?
It's this interesting thing. Like, do I use lambdas? Do I use functors? Lambdas,
yeah.
Lambdas are really wonderful. They fit really well on slides. Because they're very concise. And in a lot of things like really simple, connection pieces,
mm-hmm.
particularly, things like constructors, I find myself using a lot where I'm just, doing one-liners or two-liners. If I'm writing real code, mm-hmm. That actually has...
Real code? Oh,
sorry,
man.
Oh, my gosh. I have real code that uses lambdas. Let's be really clear.
Yeah.
Right, I have real code that uses lambdas, but if I'm doing something complex, with more than one or two, things where... The body of the lambda is, significant.
Sure.
I find myself writing functors, but lambdas, I think, have...
And so that's interesting. So why is that? Because what is really the difference? I mean, isn't it just syntactic?
It is just syntactic, right? I mean, when I take a lambda and I capture something, really all I'm doing is making it easier to capture that state and access it in a function operator.
Hmm.
But it depends, right? Sometimes you have a class that has other methods in it, for example, and it makes sense, to put them there. But I think there's a lot of tension here, though, right? When you can take, I think, really a generic route and say, golly, if I've got a class and I've got some code that just uses the public interface of that class, it really doesn't have a lot of business being a method. It should be, this public method that you can access some way. And you might want to encapsulate that in a higher level class. So that's like one side, I think, of the attention. And then there's another argument to the attention, which is, well, everything with respect to managing that class should stay in that class. And I get confused about, where the needle should be from time to time. But I think that's one of those, it should be a functor. I've got some complex state. I might have other, other ways to interact with this. It's more like an actor rather than a functor.
Yeah, because I must say that's something like when I write lambdas in C# and managed, the problem there is that it can capture state, but when you want to give it some private state, that every time, only for that lambda,
that's, right.
That's now you have to kind of write kind of strange code where really you want to kind of, put it in a class somewhere and then...
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly
yes.
it, right? About like... I'm sure people have done things like having static variables in some lambda and you assign it and golly, please only use this thing once and don't copy it or don't share it. I think some of the functors that I've written have, state, in fact, in them that gets accumulated in a variety
yes.
of manners. That's not
yeah.
just capturing the this pointer and returning, this data member or doing some simple operation on it.
But you can, that might be one of the differences with C# lambdas and C. Now I'm going to get in trouble because look who's sitting over here, man. So I'm not going to say that, but I will say that there is syntactically in C++ a way for you to specify what local variable to capture, whatever state
you
want.
The capture semantics are really different, right?
Yeah.
And you can correct me here, but I'm just not a .NET guy, unfortunately, not very much. But I believe it captures by reference by default.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the default for C++ is no capture, and you have to be explicit. And one of the things that, golly, I can't tell you how many people I've seen make this mistake where, you know, all the examples in MSDN and on people's slides everywhere, they just put, say, capture everything by reference. Mm-hmm. And then they go through and, particularly in parallel, they access it and they assign to that reference and they have a race condition or, you know, worse, corruption. And you really have to think about, well, do I want to capture this variable by value? Do I want to capture it by reference? Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've taken to do sort of as a best practice is when I write it the first time, I don't capture anything. And I let the compiler tell me what I'm capturing, mm-hmm. right? Because, you know, I do a bunch of stuff, capture some variables. I compile it. It says, you captured this, 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 and this. And then I can decide for each of those how I want to actually access it, whether it needs to be a value or a reference or whether I need to do something to actually protect that state. Mm-hmm. You know, because I want it to be referenced, but I want it to be, you know, synchronized or, you know,
sure.
or whatever. So,
cool.
Yes,
it's a great feature.
But this is an interesting thing because here I think there's a subtle difference between managed and native code. Where in native, the concept of pointers mm-hmm. and values are kind of separate, right? So, like in some sense, everything is a value, and I can have a reference to the value. Whereas In managed, you know, things are implicit references. So when you have, some value of some class, mm-hmm. now even though you know you can never, it doesn't have a value. It's always a reference. So
right.
the capturing by value makes only sense for value types.
That's right.
And so whereas in
C++,
exactly in C++ that difference is more explicit.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, when I find myself when I'm using shared pointers and unique pointers, I'm really thankful that they're much more functional over, say, auto pointer. They've addressed a lot of the issues. But it's still really, you can tell that it was something that was added mm-hmm. to the library. And it's very natural in C#, you know, to work with this. You don't actually have to see it a lot of the time.
Well, but on the other hand, if you want to have fine control, now mm-hmm. you're kind
yes.
of. Yeah. So. How often do you kind of really do kind of subtle things when you capture variables by reference, or is do you usually just go one extreme to or the other?
Well, when I'm what I find when I'm using one of these guys,
yep.
what I often find that I'm doing with this is I make it a shared pointer, you know, or it could be a unique pointer. Right? Make it a shared pointer. And then in the constructor of my class, I will initialize it. And usually I capture like this and one or two other things. Right? At least, you know, for a lot of this sort of thing. So that now I can say, capture this, you know, give it the state from the class I'm in, right? Which is on mm-hmm. this, and run some function which may or may not, you know, be on that class. Mm-hmm. So even still, usually, you know, really, really small. Because getting, you know, Lots of inline code. It's hard to test.
Sure. Shared pointer rock. It's shared pointer not to explicitly call delete.
That's right.
Well, I mean, because you get reference counting for free, and it does it in a, well, it's sort of, but it does it in a very efficient way.
And it's thread safe.
Yes. Shared pointer is really some cool stuff.
Right? And you can one of the fun things you can do is you can specify custom deleters and custom allocators. So you can actually have a shared pointer, which allocates from a pool and returns to the pool when you delete it. And that is, you know, a beautiful thing when you're stuck doing memory management, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I keep owing a sample on how to use concurrent queue.
Yes.
In fact, to manage that pool of memory, or those pool of foos, where you allocating it is, you know, you get one from the concurrent queue if it's there,
mm-hmm.
and freeing it is just putting it back on the concurrent queue.
Cool. Please do that sample, and then come on Going Native and show us how to do it.
Okay.
All right, cool.
Yeah. So to kind of go a little bit more into that, because, you know, like, again, as a kind of managed guy, right, you know, we don't have that choice, and in many cases, that's good. I mean, I'm lazy, so I hate choice. Right? I go to the supermarket, I see 500, you know, a different kind of, you know, cereal. But, you know, as when I look at native, I mean, I see so much choice. Now I have to kind of decide what kind of pointers to use. I have to decide what to capture.
Yes.
So, and I see that, you know, in certain cases, that choice is definitely useful.
Mm-hmm.
But... like when you program, do you kind of, you in most cases, do you have like a default thing and then you deviate from that in special cases, or is it always that you have to make a choice?
Well, like I said, my practice that, yes, I've learned after watching people have lambdas in parallel loops and have lots of race conditions is that I always capture nothing by default. I swear to you, I do this every single time. I capture nothing by default. Mm-hmm. I compile it. I look at what I'm capturing, and I make that choice. Which is great. When I'm writing samples, I put in an ampersand, which is capture the stack by reference. Right, because it fits, you know, it's one character. And it's, a lot of the times it is, in fact, what you want. And I think that's why we made the decision in .NET to have the default value be you know, by reference, whatever reference means in .NET.
Yes, yeah. Right?
Yeah. What does it mean, man?
Well,
it means something.
Well, it means, yeah, it means that you capture the L value, so...
Okay, that's right.
Yes.
Nice! See, the L value and R value references, see?
Well, yeah, nice. But and again, in some sense, that, like in C-sharp, most C-sharp programmers won't know what an L value is, right? Because all these things are implicit. And
that's the left-hand thing about it is, yeah, you don't need to know what an L value is. And you don't need to, heaven forbid, know what an R value is. You just capture it, and it's under the covers. It's a pointer, right? And you're copying the pointer, right?
Yeah.
Or it's a ref counted pointer.
Yeah.
But
it's things we take for granted in a world where you have a lot of the stuff abstracted away for you.
Mm-hmm.
In the C++ world, you do need to know your R value.
So maybe it's kind of fun to kind of enumerate, like, how many pointers do we have? Because we have share pointers, we have references, we have, you know, smart pointers.
Well, he's the one to ask.
Stefan.
Well, Stefan
is the one to ask, right?
Well, we have a C9 lecture on Channel 9, which is Stefan T. Lawaway, who's a boy wonder, master of the STL. In fact, he's STL at Microsoft.com. It's beautiful. He loves the language. He's passionate. He's such a great dude. Anyway, he's done a whole lecture series on Channel 9 covering the STL. One of them is on shared pointer, an advanced segment where he talks about how shared pointer is actually used in the implementation of the STL.
Right.
So he really digs into some of the quirks and things you need to think about, blah, blah, blah. Highly recommend that be watched by everyone out there. But, but in terms of this conversation, it's a good question. Like,
because again, you have this kind of, you know, it's like a big menu of like pointer types.
It's like one of those Chinese restaurants.
Yes, it's like a Chinese restaurant. Yes, do I get like, you know, broccoli with sauce, or, you know, beans with sauce, or sauce with broccoli?
Well, one of the things I try and never do is never write.
Or like pancake house, right?
I try never to write the D word, delete, right?
Okay.
Because every time I write the D word, something, like, that leaves me open to a memory leak, and I don't like tracking those down. So, shared pointer and unique pointer. If it's a simple, when do I use them? I use them...
Yeah, let's clean the board. Let's use some garbage collection
or whiteboard. Right, if it's... Right, if it's a class, foo, no. So one example, we don't need public here, we can make it a struct. But if I just have some, you know, var type, not that stupid Hungarian thing again, like, I have some var type, and I find myself wanting to do this, I'm not going to share that, and it's wholly owned by the class, but I'm going to, heaven forbid, you know, in some init function, actually allocate it. Right, where I would say, new var. Right, and then, golly, let's make sure I deinitialize it. If I'm forced to do this, we've all seen code like this. And it's, delete empty bar. Of course, you got to make sure that empty bar is, you know, not null, all that kind of stuff. You need to make sure you call the init. But you can make this just say a unique pointer.
And then you can, and if in the constructor, right, you can, you know, be a bar or whatever, right? And I don't have to worry about cleaning it up in the destructor because it'll just get destroyed. Right. And, so if this passes on a stack where there's an exception, it'll get cleaned up and all that good stuff.
So for like, you know, like a simple-minded managed programmer like me, a unique pointer, that's something where you cannot have an alias to the pointer?
Yeah, you can't copy it. Now you can always get the raw pointer out of it, you know, and do whatever you will with that, and please don't delete it, right, because that's bad. But if you want to share the pointer with someone else, then you use a shared pointer, which is copyable. Mm-hmm. And then when the last resource that holds on to it goes away, it'll get destructed.
And what happens if you get the underlying pointer and copy that? So what are the guarantees that you have on a unique pointer?
I believe the guarantees are that when you... you can call reset, you know, to set it to something else, mm-hmm. Which will clear out the old one if it's there and give it a new one. And when you destruct it, it will delete it. Or it'll call the deleter function, depending on, you know, if you've set it up. There's other, you know, things you can put between the angle brackets. And after the constructor that would let you be more specific about how you want to allocate and free that stuff.
But my question is, like you said, that was like that you cannot copy it. But can I not kind of copy it by kind of casting it to something else? And then
you can always call .get on it, yes. Right? And get the raw pointer and you do with it as you will. Mm. But please don't delete it.
Okay.
Right?
And then so it specifies more intent than a guarantee.
Right, I think this is a lot about, you know, taking this resource that you have a pointer to, and it's unique, so you don't want to share it, you don't want to copy it, and guaranteeing that when that unique pointer to it, we're going to clean up what other resources inside it when it goes away. Mm. I think, like, that's the way I interpret it.
Okay, so it's not in so much that, you know, you are the only one that can mutate it, but it's more that you know that when you let it go, then it should go away.
Right, and I can move it, right, yes. Transfer ownership from me to you. Mm-hmm. Right, and then the thing I had before doesn't have it, and you have it, and you have unique ownership over it. It's more about ownership rather than access. Right, you can access it, but who owns it? Ownership is unique. Okay. Whereas the shared pointer, ownership is shared, exactly. And ref counted in sort of the traditional sense of the way.
Yeah.
So
okay. Good. So another thing where, you know, what poor managed developers miss is templates, right?
Yes.
And so how often do you use templates, and really not in the sense of generics, but where you're really doing template metaprogramming, where you, you know, do matching and computations at the template level? Or are you just using like STL where, you know, there's the template magic in there and you don't do it yourself?
I actually write a lot of template code. It's one of the things I enjoy. One of the things that I hate is, why make a choice at runtime when you could do it at compile time? And we do it a lot because it's, say, natural and easier to, say, put a virtual method on something. But you don't actually have to do that unless you want to have, you know, say, a binary interface or some interface where you really want to share it. Because, you know, a lot of times you know at compile time, you know, whether to call this function or that function or invoke this class or, you know, to actually do anything. So connect, which I mentioned before, actually what it will go through and it actually checks to see if you're a pointer or a shared pointer or a value. It does this all through, you know, simple type traits mm-hmm. checks. And it does the right thing in a series of casts, right, to eventually get it down to, okay, here's, you know, a plain old I target and a plain old I source, and I'm going to call dot link target and it will work. Mm-hmm. And it's somewhat cumbersome, right, to do all that switching. But you can give it, say, a transformer or a reference to a transformer or a pointer to a transformer or a pointer to an I target. I think I even put in there like first message buffer or message or input buffer or something. So it would actually look on the class for the name of a particular signature and try and use that if it was there. That was one of the more fun things to, you know, to write, which is to actually, you know, go look up and does it have this member name? Okay, cool. If it does, let's use this. Otherwise, we'll just, you know, figure out whether it's a pointer or a value and then cast it to the right thing. So this is again,
I find this fascinating because, like, again, as a managed programmer, you don't have any choice, right? You know, you cannot do much computation, like hash if, you know, at compile time, but that's it. So, but here, you know, just like with pointers, you have to make like a choice what kind of thing you do. And here also, and how often, you know, did you say make a choice to do something at compile time and then later find out that really, you know, some of the things, you know, have to be deferred to runtime, and how much kind of code refactoring does that? Yes, and maybe, or also do you kind of, you know, profile your code and say, oh, you know, this thing is completely static, now move that to compile time? Or do you do this kind of thing once and then, you know, that decision is fixed?
Well, I think you can, let me tackle the first thing. So just last week, I had a class that was a class template, and it did some, you gave it a couple of different types. It had pretty almost exactly the same interface, but they were different classes. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do the same thing to each class, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, take a type, you know, do the same thing, call the same public methods because they share the code method. So that was a class template. And then I went and I changed the interface of that class, of one of them, but not the other. So I actually, you know, of course I kept using the class template, but I actually removed it from the other one to, you know, realize it because the interface wasn't the same anymore. And that was sort of like the reverse, you know, undoing it. And I felt really bad when I did it, too. I felt like I failed, right? Because I took this nice, reusable code, and I duplicated it. Mm. You know, anytime you copy and paste something and you don't, like, change almost every line of code in it, I feel like I failed a little bit. Mm. But at the end of the day, you know, it's this real balance, right? It's like, how long does it take me to you know, actually code the templates? One thing that I looked at is, like, why does it take people longer to write template code? Because it does. It's absolutely true. Whether simple template code, you know, if it's a simple container, or, you know, an STL-style algorithm, or, you know, heaven forbid, you have to go write, you know, some you know, compile time switching to, like, you know, say, I have this method, you know, when this type is set, and, you know, specialization and some of the deeper roots of it. I think it's because it's about how many layers of abstraction are you working with. Right, and when you're working with a class template, you in fact have an additional layer of abstraction than you're working with. So your compiler errors, you know, one, aren't necessarily there to guide you. IntelliSense is, you know, questionable. If you're writing some function template, which is, here's this function template, and golly, have you looked at enable if at all ever? Or which is a type trait, and you give it some compile time expression, and if that expression is true, it'll, you know, add the code that's there. If it's not, it won't. So you can actually add code that won't compile if you give it a type that doesn't make sense for. And so when you're trying to write that code and actually debug it, it takes some really sort of deep, quiet thought, and it takes, you know, a different sort of level of awareness and
yeah, energy. And so that's a good question. It's like, how do you debug that stuff? Because I'm old-fashioned, right? I'm old school. I always do console write line debugging. But now when you do a lot of computation at compile time, you know, how, you know, where do you cannot do console write line and or, you know, where do you put your breakpoints at compile time?
Well, you look at the output window and you learn to interpret the, you know, the template error messages. And at least for me, the pattern I found is, like, I compile a single file with hopefully a single error message, right, rather than my entire project, which has, you know, things all over the place. And I read the top of the error, then I go down to the very last piece of the error, and I read the bottom, then I kind of work my way back up, and I find out, okay, you know, here's this big spew. If you've ever seen the template spew that happens.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a lot. But it's navigable, and actually the error list has gotten a lot better.
Well, you have never seen the Haskell error messages type error, so.
Okay. Are those nice, Tip?
No, beautiful.
Okay.
Cannot unify, you know, five pages another five pages, and then there's somewhere in the middle, there's two kind of little things that, you know, don't match. So
nice.
But you gotta go find up. You gotta go find the spot in your code. So there's usually some CPP file that you own, right, where it's trying to instantiate whatever is having the error message. Then you gotta go look at the details of the error message. I think the worst is when there's like default copy constructors that it's calling and it's complaining about, and because you never typed them, you never see where the error is, and you just get some, like, you know, here's A, here's Z, and you go figure out what's in between them. Those are those can be, you know, no fun.
But that's definitely something that the community complains about.
Oh yeah,
and it's gotten somewhat better, but they have more work to do.
They absolutely have more work to do. And like I said, the thing that I've learned...
Or I should say, we have more work
to do. We have more work to do. We're all one big team here.
Yes.
At the end of the day.
Everybody who's involved with pushing the language in libraries.
Yeah.
Further.
Yeah, it's a lot of... It actually is a lot of work. Particularly the libraries team, the compiler team, works incredibly hard to get stuff out.
That we talked now about like the high level kind of template metaprogramming. Do you ever kind of dive into like writing inline assembly code?
Me personally,
yes.
I try to avoid that.
So you're not as hardcore as as Charles told me.
No, but then again,
I'm just joking.
But that's the beauty of the language that he uses, right?
Well, maybe you don't need to. Is that?
Yeah, it's like, where's your bottleneck? Right? If your bottleneck is computation and it's dense like that, well, maybe you are using intrinsics,
mm-hmm.
not assembly code. Maybe assembly code. Or hopefully when AMP comes out, we'll make things even better. That's what I'm hoping for.
So Charles will kind of, program his own FPGA, if it's too slow. So
it's too slow, yeah. Well, yeah, AMP's really interesting from a general purpose perspective, not just programming the GPU.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually has the potential to push the language further in some really interesting ways.
It does. I mean, being able to say, like, this function is pure is wonderful.
Did you hear that? I want to point the camera at Eric when you say that. Can you say that again?
Being able to say, this is a pure function that doesn't modify outside state. That is a thing of beauty.
That baits me. I like side effects.
It would be nice if the compiler could just tell that, of course. Right.
Yeah.
But that is that's wonderful. The other thing, and I don't think people kind of get this yet, but when you're sort of navigating this sort of, often we have like arrays of arrays of arrays. You know, whether like specifically or abstractly, it looks like a multidimensional array. Sort of navigating those pointers and dealing with elements and a range of things. I don't know about you, but every time I do that, I make mistakes. I always make range errors. Almost every developer I've ever seen makes range errors. And being able to abstract that stuff and say, here's a range of values. Work with it as, a slightly more, general mm-hmm. concept and navigate through this multidimensional space is just wonderful. And to the extent that we can raise ourselves up to that level of abstraction is going to make us much more productive. Mm-hmm. I believe.
And so how does that work when you use these kind of extensions and you run it on a machine that doesn't have the hardware capabilities? Is it then simulated in software, or do you compile your program for a specific target?
Well, Charles, you've probably actually seen it more recently than I have. I wasn't actually able to make it to the
to the keynote.
To the keynote. That's the one. Like, now that I'm a developer, because I was a program manager for a long time, I actually had real deadlines that were hard. Not that I didn't have deadlines as a PM before, but I didn't go to the talk, and I didn't get to see it sort of published in the world, which was really sad because I really wanted to go, but I had some very real deadlines.
Well, really, the stuff that they talked about there, and Eric, you would find it really mm-hmm. cool too, was essentially how it's making programming a GPU. General purpose, to the extent that C++ developers can mm-hmm. do it without having to write C. Because
mm-hmm.
today, everybody has to write C in DirectX or OpenGL and blah, blah, blah. OpenGL does have a C++ port.
OpenCL.
OpenCL, sorry. They do have a sort of a C++ thing on top of it, but blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Anyway, it's not to the extent of what AMP will promise, so Herb says and others, and I believe mm-hmm. them because these are language changes. But to answer your question, we mainly saw incredible performance, man, like ridiculous performance in very small lines of code that mm-hmm. C++ developers could look at and go, wow, that's cool.
Yeah,
I understand it.
Yeah,
that's what, to me, resonated.
Yeah, it's one, if that's your workload, which is sort of this dense computation, navigating through either, lots of the same spaces or, a really, complex space, wonderful, right?
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't really knock OpenCL and CUDA.
Absolutely
because they're
not.
Like, those are wonderful technologies. And AMP is another wonderful technology, right? Mm-hmm. And it's built on DirectX 11, right? Which is kind of a a big deal. I have this wonderful laptop. It has both, I say wonderful, right? It has this high-powered DX11 card, and it has this integrated card, you know, so for when I'm not plugged into the, you know, into the wall and wanting to consume 100 watts or whatever it takes to do this thing. Yeah. And it can, I believe it will run in software mode. And I believe they've been, you know, working through some things to actually get, you know, some more computation out of it.
Sure.
But I think part of the thing where it looks like library, it's got language extensions, but it looks like library, is it enables you to sort of go smoothly between, say, PPL and AMP and back and forth. So there's now a path for composition. You don't have to learn everything all over again, right? You add to what you've learned. Rather than like, okay, I've learned this technology, now I have to go learn this technology, and it's going to take me a half year to ramp up. And I think that's the big thing. And we have tools.
Yeah.
Right, so.
Totally. I mean, AMP is built on Concert and the work that you guys did. I mean, already. I mean, it's all iterative.
Yeah, it's all, I mean, even if, it's iterative and it sits well together, I think, which is important. So,
absolutely, man.
So one last question, because we talked a little bit about Lambdas, and when we talked with Erk, we talked a lot about like new features in C++. So I would like to ask you, what is your kind of, you know, favorite new C++ feature?
I have that now recorded forever. Erk asking that question.
In Visual Studio 2010, for a long time it was Lambdas, and I think it maybe still is, but close to running is Auto. Because I really like not. I mean, we've been without var for a really long time, and I don't know if you've ever looked at the types of iterators on containers, but they're really long. And so if I have, you know,
but and especially if you use Hungarian, now you write the type twice.
Yeah. Oh my gosh! And the nice thing, so I can say auto, and it's the beginning of an iterator, right? And then I go change the container. I don't have to change all my references to my iterator before, and that's like. I don't use auto all over the place, but anytime I'm worried about the type changing on me as a return value of a function, I use it.
Awesome.
And I love that. I have my, you know, wish list for C++ OX for the features that aren't out yet, like being able to. But the one that I notice is if I have a class template with a lot of template parameters, I'd like to have
variadic templates.
Well, variadic templates and partial template type definitions, right? Nice. So that I can say, you know, here's a subset of the templates, you know, predefined, and I just want to specify this one. And of course, I can do it with macro, but those things are, you know.
It's not modern, dude.
This is called currying, man. It's all old school.
Yeah.
All right, well.
Excellent. This was fun.
That was fun. Good.
And hopefully we can come back and see his
beep, beep, beep. Yes.
Right on, man.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Take care, Rick. We'll see you again soon.
See you.
Cheers.